The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center in Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the weekly Dharma series.
Good to be together. Always nice to take a minute just to take you all in. It's about 87 people on Zoom this morning, and probably some more on YouTube. So quite a large group of seekers here today, which is always wonderful. And not a small thing to just let that touch the heart. Yeah. It's complicated living in this world among people like us who are messy. Sometimes we can forget that the world is dotted with a lot of goodness too, just like now. I've been giving a few talks exploring mindfulness, what mindfulness is, and how to cultivate the depth and breadth of mindfulness. And it may seem like, well, yeah, but I'll continue that today and talking about a little bit about the Brahmaviharas as a strength of our mindfulness practice. And the Pali word for it that's translated as mindfulness often, or awareness sometimes, is sati. And that word can really be defined as to remember, or, you know, sometimes there are these in the teachings, in the scriptures, examples of remembering teachings from a long time ago, right? And or holding it in mind or bearing in mind. So it's not just a focus, right? Which is what we often, I think, I'll just speak for myself, can forget that mindfulness is not the same as focus. You know, like we tell children to pay attention. What we mean is we want you to focus on this, right? And just being told that so often, or hearing that colloquially so often, we can bring us that same misunderstanding into our Dharma practice. Like we have to focus harder and stronger, right? But it's not that focusing harder and stronger that we need to do. It's to keep and hold something in mind. And that holding in mind is often be holding in mind our intentions for our practice in our life, right? Or remembering a valuable teaching to support our engagement with practice, right? Like remembering that this is just nature. Often the instructions that I've been offering are reminders. This is just nature. Everything is moving, right? So it's not like focus harder and stronger. It's like, just remember, friends, let's remember together that experience is just nature and everything belongs. Every experience belongs because it's arising naturally, lawfully, due to causes and conditions, not because we've made it happen or didn't make it happen. But isn't this the way it goes in practice? We think like, oh, if practice is pleasant or goes the way I want it to go, then I did a good job. And if practice is unpleasant, or the mind is too busy, or what I'm experiencing is not skillful habits of mind, then I'm doing something wrong. Right? Nod your head if you can relate. Same with you too? Yeah, it's like that, right? But so to tease this apart a little bit and understand, like, oh yeah, it's not about forcing or demanding. It's about remembering. And sustaining a recollection. And one of the valuable, we chant the four quarters chant in the beginning, to bear something in mind that will take us through the meditation. It's like the beginning. It's what I really think as the beginning of the meditation, the chanting and letting the words land in the heart, remembering the value of kindness, remembering the value of not rejecting suffering because kindness can meet that, remembering the value of not rejecting joy because kindness can be met right there too, right? A kind of kind heart that reflects back something joyful. And that kind of kind awareness that is really courageous. Because there are probably many times that we want to get up and leave, but we don't. We just stay, make an adjustment and stay. That's the kind wisdom of equanimity, the cool wisdom of equanimity, we might say, right? The value of remembering, like, oh, this moment matters. Even though this doesn't feel perfect, it's not perfect, or it isn't what I want it to be, feels harder than I want it to be, right? That I'm going to just see what I can learn here, right? Wisdom does that for us. It's the value of wisdom that meets us right there in the moment. So in chanting these four, hey, Arlita, these four expressions of kindness, we're encouraging the mind to just remember them and linger with them as we go along. I'm in a sutta study group with some people around the world once a month, and last month we studied the sutta, and it was about the 11 doors to the deathless. Deathless is one of the synonyms for nirvana, right? So to just kind of go big right now. One of the doors to the deathless, there are 11 of them. We don't need to enter through all of them, but you know, there are 11 options, right? And four of the 11 are the Brahmaviharas. So metta, compassion, or loving kindness, compassion, gladness, or appreciative joy and equanimity, four of the doors to the deathless. Yeah. And they're powerful doors for us, right? Very powerful doors. If we spent the rest of our lives kind of exploring each of these qualities of the heart, these good qualities of the heart, it would be plenty because it would take us everywhere, actually. So a door to the deathless is not like saying that love, you know, without love we're doomed, but it's like really pointing to the function of love, I think, that kindness, or, and I'm using words interchangeably here, kindness, friendliness, benevolence, metta, all different ways of describing this heart that knows how to include, right? And why do we include what's painful? Because it's nature, right? Because there's wisdom that reminds us this is just a naturally occurring expression in this moment. It's not our fault. It's not something that we need to control or manipulate. We can participate, right? And wisdom guides and supports our skillful participation, right? And that's where the wisdom of the wisdom of effort comes along. The wisdom of the effort to abide in skillful places and to not linger in unskillful places. So when the mind is doing its thing and ruminating about something that doesn't feel very skillful, then the wisdom of effort goes like, oh, should we keep doing that? Right? There's wisdom right there that participates with that, right? That gets curious about what's the most skillful thing to do. And sometimes wisdom will just move away from that, withdraw from that experience, right? Or here I am beating myself up in the thought world, interestingly, always in the thought world, beating myself up about what's not going well. And then wisdom recognizes that, wisdom awareness recognizes that. And that effort is to, what do we do here? I mean, this is a choice point, a point of exercising our agency in practice. Right. It's actually the place that we have the most agency is in watching the mind. That's how it seems to me anyway. Right? We don't have a lot of say over how things play out in our world and in our lives. We do have some influence, of course, always have some influence, but that influence is really born out of watching our minds and making choices like this, or wisdom supporting the choices that we're making, right? And then that goodness, that skillfulness, you know, when we're making wise choices about, you know, then influences everything else that we see and feel relationally and in the world, right? Because if the mind is caught up in its, oh, I can watch this over and over and over, like the mind that's caught up in its unskillful places, then just respond as if those unskillful places are absolute truth, right? Like, you know, this person hurt me and they're out to get me, and I need to respond as if that's true. And then have a conversation with the person and realize, oh, that's not true, right? Versus like watching the mind that's really creating a story or a habit, some kind of story about what's true, acting it out, but instead watching that all play out, right? And meeting, including that with love. And so now, you know, there's a bit of skillful doubt there. I don't know if I should believe this. It's, you know, I don't really know. And even if I think it's true, is it the most skillful thing to play it out? Or is there another option, right? I'll read a little bit from this book, Hardest Wide is the World, Sharon Salzberg. The very short chapters, like just a couple of pages long. And this is a chapter on the heavenly abodes. I'll skip around a little. She said, the heavenly abode, she's talking about the practices of loving kindness. She says, I traveled to many places in the world to teach the practice of the four Brahma Viharas, or heavenly abodes, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. I am continually surprised that no matter where I go, so many people consider these states of mind as weaknesses. Students at a retreat will say, if I am loving and compassionate, I will allow myself to be abused and hurt. To me, those are just sweet sentiments, but it's not really possible to live like that. Sadly, this attitude misses what tremendous strength lies in the Brahma Viharas. They are the source of acknowledging and cultivating our profound connection with life. The writer Wendell Berry says that the smallest unit of health is a community. Community is another way of saying connection, and connection is life itself. This is revealed again and again in various studies. For instance, people who have suffered a heart attack seem to heal more quickly if they have pets, as compared to those who do not. When other variables are controlled, cancer patients who join a support group tend to live longer than those who do not. Those who are prayed for when sick, even if they are unaware of the prayers, do better than those who are not prayed for. The mysterious root of healing is connection. The four Brahma Viharas are practices that inspire and deepen our connection to each other. In this way, they extend healing not only to ourselves, not only to others, but to ourselves. The word healing shares the same root as wholeness. We do not exist as separate, isolated beings. We are part of a community of all beings. That is our wholeness. The Brahma Viharas are practices that cultivate our faith in our own loving hearts and in the strength of our own connection with others. She says, all four of these practices are accomplished by inclining the mind towards love and connection. We begin with someone for whom it is easy to feel, for us to feel loving kindness or compassion or sympathetic joy or equanimity. Slowly, the field of our attention expands to include others we care for, those to whom we feel indifferent, those we dislike, and finally, all beings everywhere. In doing these practices, we are not striving for artificial sentiments, nor attempting to conform to an abstract idea of a spiritual person. We're not squashing feelings of outrage that we might have or repressing our healthy-minded fear. Love, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity do not distort our ability to see clearly, but rather as we realize that we are together with all beings, they transform the reasons we work to create change. Our motivation or our mental posture becomes one of inclusion rather than separation. And as we grow stronger in the practice of the Brahma Viharas, we find that we can honestly and directly look at problems and take strong action as we care of ourselves and others. We find the ultimate healing truth of connection. Anybody like that? So beautiful, right? And such a complete expression of what the Brahma Viharas are, yeah, and what they're not. I was listening to a talk by Ajahn Suchito, and he said that the doors of the deathless, you know, he was remembering, I think, the Buddha's second teaching, which the Buddhist must have said something like, the doors of the deathless are open for those who bring forth their faith. And I just was reflecting on this, the habits of loving kindness, right? The habits of the heart that knows how to care and connect, to feel in connection, to not take any of the off ramps that lead us to a feeling of separation or aloneness, or like I have to do all this by myself, like forgetting that we're all doing something together here. And, you know, how powerful it is, like the mind's habits to take any of those off ramps at any time. They are. And especially when it's hot, right? When there's a lot of heat or friction. And this is a time that we're living in with a lot of that. I'm not sure it's actually quite different than other times in our life, but we're in the political cycle now, or we're approaching the general election. And yeah, it's just more and more evident to me that how the mind forms opinions and creates an opposition always, right? And how, and the practices of loving kindness, this for those who can bring forth their faith, right? It's like, what are we relying on? Are we relying on this habit of being right and creating an other? Or are we actually holding ourselves accountable to abiding in a kind of goodness that is going to be supportive in our lives? Are we exploring the vast terrain of loving kindness? Are we really willing to do that? Or are we just going to take an easy way out? Right? Because as Sharon was speaking here, this seems like a vast terrain of loving kindness to me. Right? There's nothing left out of this. But I notice in my own mind the inclination to just like construct a view and an other in a moment. Like, but is it possible to have views? Like, this is a good question for us. Is it possible to have views and to work for justice without somehow throwing other beings out of our hearts, right? And I'm not saying that's easy. It's not easy for me. And I don't think it's easy for anybody. So, but the practice of it is not supposed to be easier, and it's not supposed to be an end, actually, right? It's not supposed to be something we just get and cruise through. It's not how, at least in my experience, that's not how freedom expresses itself. There are these moments when the heart remembers to keep in mind the possibility of kindness or the possibility of non-hatred or non-ill will, because loving kindness is actually described that way, like non-ill will, the absence of ill will. It doesn't have to mean like warm, oozy love, right? It's like, can the mind abide, remember to have faith or confidence in the power of this skillful quality of heart and mind in this moment, even when it feels confusing, even when there's, you know, we're going to have views, right? And we're going to work towards creating the kind of life that is in alignment with the healthiest, most skillful views that we have. That's just what we're going to do as human beings, right? So can, while we have a view, is it possible to have a view that's also supported by love, right? Or to take action in a way that is supported by love, kindness, some appreciation, right? Some remembering, if we define loving kindness as connection, right? Some remembering that this belongs because this is nature, to go back to that earlier thing I was saying. One of the ways Sharon Salzberg defines loving kindness, there's many ways it can be defined, like this expression of the good heart or the kind heart. Benevolence, friendliness are some of the common descriptions, loving kindness, obviously. But she describes loving kindness as a sensibility. In an interview, I think she was asked, how do you describe, you know, what is it actually? And she said, it's a sensibility, right? It's just sensible. It's sensible to not throw ourselves or other beings out of our hearts, right? And we find that possibility in connection with ourselves, like in ordinary moments, right? When we're sitting on the cushion, this is the connection back with sati, mindfulness, right? In a moment of connection with ourselves, we discover something that we like or that we don't like, and we don't abandon it. We find a skillful way to relate, right, to this habit that's here and now. And in that, that's the function, right? The function of loving kindness is to include. So what's that like to include and to see clearly, right? Oh, this is not skillful. It's not like we're denying that this is, we're not trying to say this habit of mind is skillful when it's not. Just like we're not trying to say that habits other beings express or that we express in the world are skillful when they're not. We're not pretending, right? But we're honestly looking for a way to include. What does it take to include this expression of humanity right now? What does it take to include this? What kind of wisdom is needed right now? Right? Where does the heart need to linger? Where does it need to abide? What does it need to hold in mind in order to support an inclusive view in this moment? There's a advertisement I saw not long ago for, it was like, I think a chocolate commercial, maybe some of you saw it, but it was some children and with a plate of chocolate in front of them. And the person, the adult, was saying, like, take a piece of chocolate if you eat all your vegetables, right? And they take a piece of chocolate. Take a piece of chocolate if you're the tallest, right? Take a piece of chocolate if you like to share, right? And there's like one piece of chocolate, and the children look down at the chocolate and they kind of looked at each other and, and no one smiled. And then one child grabbed a piece of chocolate and gave it to her friend, and they both like giggled and giggled and giggled, right? And that's like, you know, it made me happy to watch that. And I immediately thought of mudita, right? This quality of gladness, like when the heart is happy for somebody's happiness, especially when like children learn something, it's so sweet when you're watching them learn something in real time, like, oh, I don't really like to share all the time and I can't lie, you know, but right now I'll try it, right? And they learned, and then, you know, they both felt like the happiness of being the one who's sharing and being the one who had something shared with them, right? And it just reminded me of, like, you know, what that's like to sometimes, you know, that moment of lingering and the not sharing, like where they both didn't smile and kind of look down and realize, like, I don't really like to share. And, you know, that's a moment you got to wait to see what happens next, right? We don't always know what's going to happen next. But if we stopped caring in that moment, right, it would be unfortunate, right? Because I was curious. I mean, this is kind of a simple, but it was a lesson of mind, right? It was a simple lesson of mind. Because our minds can so easily, like, somebody did a dumb thing, that's it. You know, I'm gonna hold that. I'm gonna like see them through that lens forever. One second, let me finish this. Sorry, I'll forget it. Did
No,
you?
that's fine.
Oh. You know, like how often is that? That's not your fault. How often is it that we do that, right? We look at another person through the lens of their worst moment of their lives, right? Or we don't encourage our hearts to see any further than that. But waiting to see what comes next, like what comes next, right? Is there more learning that happens? And what about, you know, what about our community's learning, right? How do we support the ongoing, if loving kindness is a community, like how do we support that ongoing willingness to keep learning together or allowing each other to learn to see what comes next? Like, does the heart rebound? Does it remember to abide in goodness when it forgets in another moment, right? And isn't that a sweet thing to keep in mind as we go through our day with our relationships with our friends and family? To remember that, oh, we're just learning. Let's see what comes next, right? This is from one of the suttas. The Buddha's talking about the value of metta. He says, monastics, when universal love leading to universal love is sometimes the way metta is described. But, you know, remember, it can be described many ways. When universal love leading to liberation of mind is ardently practiced, developed, unrelentingly resorted to, used as one's vehicle, made the foundation of one's life, fully established, well consolidated and perfected, then these 11 blessings may be expected. What 11? One sleeps happily. One wakes happily. One does not suffer bad dreams. One is dear to human beings. One is dear to non-human beings. The gods protect one. No fire or poison or weapon harms one. One's mind gets quickly concentrated. The expression of one's face is serene. One dies unperturbed. And even if one fails to attain higher states, one will at least reach the state of the Brahma world. Monastics, when universal love leading to liberation of mind is ardently practiced, developed, unrelentingly resorted to, used as one's vehicle, made the foundation of one's life, fully established, well consolidated and perfected, then these 11 blessings may be expected. I mean, the 11 blessings were good, but this part of, you know, when love is ardently practiced, ardently, right? With persistence and warmth. Ardently can be described as that way, like persistent. Sun is persistent. And it can also be described as like warmth of feeling, right? So not that forcefulness, but that steadiness that remembers to relax and to care, to feel. So when universal love is ardently practiced, developed, when we keep learning, right? Keep willing, being willing to learn, unrelentingly resorted to, unrelentingly, all of those off-ramps and dodges, right? The heart makes just to recognize them. And in that moment of recognition and inclusion, then, you know, it's actually a moment of love anyway. Used as one's vehicle, made the foundation of one's life. Fully established, well consolidated and perfected. Right? That's so good. That's just such a good teaching, right? There will be many, we can just say there will be many blessings that follow. And the kids are going to be here any minute, but I'll read one more. This is from Acharya Buddharakita from an article in Access to Insight. He says, but let not metta be mistaken as mere sentiment. It is the power of the strong. If the leaders from different walks of life were to give metta a fair trial, no principle or guideline to action would be found to possess greater efficiency or fruitfulness in all spheres. But let not metta be mistaken as a mere sentiment, right? That's the weakness that Sharon was pointing to, the unfortunate view that metta is weak. It is the power of the strong. If the leaders from different walks of life were to give metta a fair trial, no principle or guideline to action would be found to possess greater efficiency or fruitfulness in all spheres. And like, if we were really to test it out, metta is one of the three wise intentions, right? So to remember, perhaps as we move back into our day and engage our life in the week ahead, that instead of that kind of forcefulness of directing, that to remember what we intend, right? What is our motivating force? What is the motivating force of our lives, right? What do we want to guide us? And in the Buddhist teachings, there are three wise intentions. Intention gets a lot of press because it's so powerful like this. So it's kind of like the depth and breadth of our heart. Yeah. That spreads out, like all of the activities that we take and all of the ways that we engage arise from the power of intention, right? And so what do we, and when our intentions, when attention, you know, is guided by intention, right? Then our lives become like a force of whatever intentions are there. Yeah. So the intention of renunciation, to be simple, to actually be, you know, we can think about this as being present. That simplicity is like not getting pulled away by around by everything we can be pulled around by, but actually just being here when we're here. And this intention of metta or intention of goodwill is one of the three wise intentions, right? This intention of kindness, benevolence, and this intention of harmlessness, right? And these wise intentions are antidotes to three unwise intentions. So the intention of renunciation sort of is counters the intention to be pulled around by craving. So the intention to be simple, to just be here, is different, right? And we can remember that, like when we are pulled around by craving. I was doing a little exercise this morning and I recognized the desire, the craving to check the time every 30 seconds to see how much time I had left, right? And then I was just like practicing feeling that impulse and just relaxing around it. So not forcing the mind not to do it, because that feels worse. It feels like, oh, I want to do this, but I can't do it, right? But it's just like recognizing, oh, the mind is pulled in this direction. Is it okay to care about that and to just keep breathing? And it was actually quite fine, right, to do it that way. And so the intention of goodwill sort of counters the unskillful intention of ill will. So when we notice the mind that's demonizing another or ourselves, right, in a moment, it's the heart is full of hatred in that moment. And the intention of goodwill softens around that experience. So it's not like we have to force that experience to not be there. That would be pretending, right? What we do is just feel it. Oh, feel, you know, it's actually painful to be driven around by craving, right? It feels unpleasant in the body. And so does that constrictedness of ill will, right? And so the heart that softens around, that cares about it, softens into that intention for goodwill without throwing anything away, without saying, well, this isn't something, this heart is supposed to feel. We're not trying to make ourselves into those kind of creatures, right? We're just accepting what it's like to be a human being. And then this intention of harmlessness, counters the intention to be harmful, right? And perhaps, that is maybe self-explanatory. All right, friends.
This talk, like all programs at Common Ground, is offered freely in the spirit of generosity. To learn more about Common Ground and its programs, or if you would like to donate, please visit our website, www.commongroundmeditation.org.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.